This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's like dodging a bullet in slow motion.
Greece is still trying to avoid a financial collapse one day at a time.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from marketplace.org. It's Thursday, March 8th.
Coming up, Greek investors decide between losing a lot or losing a lot more.
Also, what a Big Mac can tell us about the health of the economy.
And I've got one word for you, just one word.
iPad.
Sounds like three to me. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start today with the Marketplace global perspective as investors who've lent money to Greece give the country either a thumbs up or thumbs down. Today's the deadline for deciding if they want to swap the bonds they already hold for ones worth around 70% less. That's what's known among lenders as a big haircut. But some investors complain it's more like a scalping and they plan to vote no. Investment manager Patrick Armstrong is among them. He's on the line with us from London. Good day, sir.
Good day. How are you?
Good, thank you. You own Greek bonds, so what's the process that you're going through today?
So Greece is looking for a voluntary participation in a restructuring of its debt today. We've got a small holding in Greek bonds. We voted no, that we won't be participating in the restructuring on a voluntary basis. However, Greece passed a law last week where if 66% of people who vote yes, then Greece now has the ability to force everyone to participate on the same terms as the people who did it voluntarily.
But if too many people vote no, many critics say that it could spark a messy default and another financial crisis. Why risk that?
Well, our holding is so small, we're immaterial, really. We've got a fraction of a percent in our portfolios, and it's a very, very, very high probability that there'll be enough votes to get the collection action clauses through.
Briefly, sir, do you think things with Greece are as dire as many people make them out to be?
Things with Greece are dire. They'll be getting 130 billion euros in a couple of weeks, and that'll see them through the next 2 years, almost. And the forecasts are that Greece will continually bring its debt as a percentage of the size of its economy down over the next 8 years towards 120% of its GDP. And we don't think Greece will generate the type of economic growth that's needed to do that. So we expect Greece will be defaulting again in a couple of years' time.
Investment manager Patrick Armstrong in London, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, if all goes well, we'll get past this hurdle in the European debt crisis and probably move on to another one. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is here with his crisis crystal ball. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So if we pass this deadline today and these Greek bondholders agree to a debt swap, then tomorrow morning everything's okay or what?
No. I mean, there will be a sigh of relief. It does look as if the Greeks will now get the first chunk of the second bailout loan in time to avoid what you say is it could be a messy default later this month. But is this the end of the crisis? No. And here's the problem. The Greeks have to keep cutting their budget to reduce their deficit to qualify for more bailout money. Gabriel Stein of Lombard Street Research says that with these budget cuts, Greece is locked into a downward spiral.
The economy grows weaker or rather contracts more, and that means that relative to the size of the economy, the budget deficit actually widens rather than narrows. That means that they can sort of never catch up. They have to run twice as fast to stay in the same place.
And before the end of this year, he believes the EU and the IMF will say to Greece, you're not meeting the bailout terms, you're not getting any more money. Then, he says, Greece will default and exit the eurozone, followed perhaps by one or two other countries.
And what about those others, Stephen? I mean, what about Italy and Spain and Portugal? Even if we get past this Greece deadline, are there problems there?
Well, Portugal's the most at risk. If Portugal went, then certainly Spain and Italy might not be that far behind. But the whole Eurozone is creaking right now. For the first time, a major political leader in the Netherlands of all places, has called for his country to drop the euro. So This remains a deeply troubled currency block.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
The government said this morning that the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits ticked up slightly last week to 362,000, but the four-week average remains near the lowest level in 4 years. Tomorrow, the Labor Department will give us the much broader February jobs report.
And we'll give Diane Swonk the job of reading these economic tea leaves. Diane is chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she's with us from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So some good news this morning on the job front. And we also heard from the job placement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas that the number of planned layoffs was up last month, which, of course, doesn't sound great. But here's what CEO John Challenger told us about it.
Companies are making decisions. They're not just waiting things out. So it's a healthy sign, especially because the job creation has been trumping the losses. That's a sign of a more energetic, active economy.
An active economy. Is that your view, Diane?
Well, it's maybe active on a walker, but we are moving forward, and that's the important issue. And I think the point here is one that we saw in the 1990s. The Fortune 500 downsized the entire 1990s, yet we had a virtual job boom out there as new businesses were created. And we are starting to see in some of the different employment reports that it looks like new business formation is starting to pick up. That maybe is something as simple as someone who works for a large company now consulting that large company and the company moving to get that flexibility or hiring back people as consultants, or they're outsourcing innovative niche technologies that's happening in some of the medical sector where they're using smaller companies to do their innovation rather than doing it in-house.
All right, well, let's talk about something else that happened this morning. McDonald's came out and said that same-store sales were up 11% here in the U.S. last month and just 2% higher in Asia. What's going on there?
I think you're seeing the rebalancing of growth. The U.S. is reaccelerating, although not rapidly, and it's pushing people downstream in terms of where they eat. On the other side of it, Asia's been a really big, strong market for McDonald's. And because it's such a global player, when you see major shifts in the growth patterns, you start to really pay attention to it. It's showing that Asia's having a spillover effect from the weakness we're seeing in Europe. And now Asia and many of the emerging markets were concerned about how much they're going to slow in their growth.
Does McDonald's really tell us a lot about the economy, or just kind of whether people like, you know, Big Macs or Quarter Pounders better?
I actually think because of the placement of McDonald's, it does show some movement in terms of where people are trying to find value in the economy. And more broadly, because it's an international company, these changes we see in growth across regions, major regions of the world, are really important. So it is an indicator that is worth watching out there.
And finally, quickly, Diane, there's this deadline happening later today. These Greek bondholders have to decide whether they're going to accept big losses on their investments. And if they don't, it could trigger a messy default in Greece. What do you think? What's going to happen? How important is this?
It's important, and I don't think they have any other choice. They have no other choice to move forward, and they will move forward. That's the good news. The bad news is we're moving from a crisis situation in Europe to a chronic illness, and anyone who's had a chronic illness knows there's still a lot of crises down the road.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Time now for our weekly attitude check.
And the latest poll number suggests margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Gallup editor-in-chief Frank Newport joins us now, as he does every Thursday. And today he's got gas prices in focus. And maybe $4 a gallon isn't so bad after all. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So when it comes to tipping points for consumers, is $5 the new $4?
It sure looks like it. That's what we found when we asked Americans, and this is very, very important in terms of price sensitivity. What is the price of gasoline at which you would significantly alter your lifestyle and at which you would significantly have to cut back in spending in other areas? And the answer was $5.30 and $5.34. So it certainly looks to us like, and we're nowhere near an average of $5.30 a gallon, but it would need to be up to that price before we really see, as you say, a tipping point where a lot of Americans had to alter their behavior.
And who do Americans blame for these gas price increases?
It's an excellent question. Historically, it was the oil companies. But just recently, in the last couple of weeks, Pew Research asked just that question, who do you blame? Open-ended question. And nobody got most of the blame. Obama got 18%, the oil companies 14%, the situation in Iran and the Middle East 11%. Speculation, which Obama mentioned in his press conference the other day, only about 4%. So there was no one villain that's getting all the blame at the moment.
Well, no matter who they blame, is this something that should keep President Obama awake at night as the election nears?
Boy, he should lay awake at night hoping that the price of gasoline doesn't get to $5.30. How's that? Because we know, obviously, in a re-election year, people's perceptions of the economy, how they feel the economy is doing, will affect his chances of being reelected. And as we just talked about, if the price of gasoline gets to that price, it could affect his reelection chances. But at the moment, the last time I saw it, the average price was, you know, $3.70, $3.80. So we're far away from that at the moment.
Well, $5 would sure keep me awake. Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
So this week is the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and a lot of it can be a little inside baseball, but one announcement might hit home for a number of our listeners. There is a new SimCity game on the horizon.
Oh, I remember playing that game.
Yeah, me too, Bob. Then this is going to be the first one in around 5 years, first update to the game, and it's going to be completely in 3D. Hmm. Here to talk with us for our Midday Extra is Jeff Ryan, a video and computer game expert and author. Hi, Jeff.
How are you doing?
Doing well. So why did it take them so long, 5 years, to come out with a new SimCity?
Well, there are curved roads in this one, and you can't just curve a road automatically. You know, it took about 20 years of innovation before you got a curved road.
That's what it is? That's what takes so long?
No, seriously. What SimCity is now going to be based on a new technology called Glassbox. Now, the other SimCities were top-down. Basically, you built a firehouse, and then that said, okay, no more fires. This is going to go from the bottom up, meaning you have 10,000 houses all around with 10,000 people in them all doing 100,000 things. And at any given point, there could be a fire. If you build a firehouse, that simply means that the truck is going to have to leave and drive all the way there, and then you'll get to watch the firemen come out and put out the fire. It's an actual real city full of real fake people.
Listen, Jeff, if I'm mayor and I say there's a curved road there, there's a curved road there, I'm telling you. Do you have any memories of playing SimCity?
Oh, yeah. If in the Nintendo version of SimCity, if you got to, I think, 500,000 people, they automatically erected a statue of Mario. And for SimCity diehards, I'm happy to report that Godzilla is still a part of SimCity. He will still start wandering through at random.
Is this game likely to do well among today's what is the target audience for SimCity right now? Is it still I played it when I was like a teenager, but who are they going after?
Well, there's a huge new audience, everyone who's playing Farmville and Cityville and all of the other Zynga Facebook games, because that has an interactivity component. You have your little whatever it is, and you can send little fruits and vegetables or gifts or whatever to other people's computers who then send stuff back to you. Now, imagine this is a real full city with, you know, a game that's actually worth playing. Then you have some interesting commerce that you can set up. You can have a real city going on.
I wonder, are sequels like this one as big a deal in the video game industry as they are in Hollywood?
They are. The first Sims game, which is a spinoff of SimCity, sold 16 million copies. It's still the highest-selling PC game of all time. Hmm. And the Sims franchise sold over 100 million games.
You know, I'm still waiting for the invention of fusion power plants in the real world after having played SimCity and knowing that it was supposed to come around now, 2010. I don't know when they invented it.
And they were so easy. You just point and click, and there it is.
There it is. And all of a sudden, you don't have to have any other power plants. But
would that it were that easy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Jeff Ryan, video and computer game expert and author, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot. For the first time in 15 years, Peyton Manning is no longer an Indianapolis Colt. The team ended its contract with a star who, by one estimate, helped boost the Colts' value nearly fivefold to well above $1 billion. So what does Manning's departure mean for the team's net worth now? Here's Sally Herships.
Let's break down the Colts' decision like we do a post-game analysis. Here's what it seems like the team was thinking.
So what do you do when you're stuck with an aging, expensive, and injured quarterback?
Lose the old player and draft Stanford University star Andrew Luck. That's according to Victor Matheson, a sports economist at College of the Holy Cross.
Last year, with essentially the same team, but without Peyton Manning, they became one of the worst teams in the NFL.
This year, the Colts will save $28 million that would have gone to Manning. And thanks to NFL salary caps, rookies come cheap. Matheson says Luck should only cost the team half what Manning did. But without its longtime star, the Colts will have to change the way they promote themselves. Chris Lincheski is president of Comcast's Front Row Marketing.
They will tell you that it's about the horseshoe on the helmet and not the name on the back.
But it won't hurt that the Colts are expected to have a new star named Luck. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
So, Bob, how would you like to have your own font?
I think I do.
Do you?
No.
You know, actually, I've noticed that you print out your notes in a different font than I do. I stick with this. I guess this is like Helvetica or Arial or something like that. And you prefer the more...
I prefer the Sans
the
type.
The Sans type. Well, the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee wants to have its own font or typeface. It is joining a growing list of U.S. cities that do this to be used in everything from stationery to street signs. Blake Farmer of WPLN reports.
The former industrial town of Chattanooga has experienced a renaissance with new art museums, bike trails, and walking bridges. In the midst of repurposed factories is a city-owned skateboard park. The added amenities attract transplants, and natives like 27-year-old biologist and skater Kevin Parr say they're no longer itching to leave.
Tell me this. Has Chattanooga become cool enough to get its own typeface?
I'm not sure what a typeface is.
It's nerd speak for a font. European cities often have their very own. Some American cities have a special typeface, but not one that's been custom made.
Alexandria, Virginia, for example, uses one of my fonts called Aviano Sans.
Jeremy Dooley designed a font just for his adopted hometown of Chattanooga called Chat Type. It has a stencil look inspired by local railroads, bridges, and company logos. Jonathan Mansfield helped create Chat Type.
It's to simply say, see how this feels? Chattanooga feels the same way.
A handful of businesses have committed to using the font. The creators are raising money online so they can provide it for free to city government. They hope it will be used in tourism materials and become a signature for the city. Designer DJ Trishler says he'd like to see the font on every corner.
It would be awesome if it was being used for that restroom sign. It would be awesome if all the rules for the skateboarding park over there had Chat Type in it.
Chattanooga Councilman Andre McGarry calls Chat Type a sexy idea that just needs to overcome some practical hurdles.
Well, it depends on a couple of things. Number one, it depends on a lot of paint.
For street signs, McGarry says Chat Type needs to pass some legibility tests.
But I think if people really want to see this adopted, those pieces come.
Chat Type's designers say it's only for the locals, but they hope to inspire what they call a typeface revolution when every big city has its own font. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
The new iPad unveiled by Apple yesterday will hit store shelves next Friday, although perhaps not in China. A Chinese company claims it owns the name there and is still trying to block iPad sales. As Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai, the case is turning into a headache for the Chinese government.
If Apple wins the right to keep the iPad name in China, Chinese companies would likely protest how a big U.S. corporation used its clout to reverse a Chinese court decision. But if Apple should lose this case, other American companies in China will take notice, says Stan Abrams, an intellectual property lawyer in Beijing.
They're going to yell about it. There's going to be the usual op-eds being written about what this means. They're going to try to roll it into a big narrative about the state-owned sector and how private companies aren't being treated well. The usual stuff that you read every day.
The problem is, says Abrams, they wouldn't necessarily have a reason to complain. Abrams says the Chinese government is proceeding cautiously, not letting politics to enter into the debate. He says that's a reassuring sign that the Apple case, whatever the outcome, won't carry any broader meaning for foreign companies in China. A Chinese appellate court is expected to issue a final decision on whether Apple can call an iPad in China within the next few months. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And finally, when Apple took the wraps off its new iPad yesterday, it turned out that the big differences between it and the old iPad are a faster processor and better graphics. Not all that exciting, but listen to how Apple CEO Tim Cook talked about it.
The new iPad, more amazing than the iPad 2. This is incredible. iPad is everywhere. iPad, 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 iPad. The amazing new iPad. We are just getting started.
Wow. Can't wait to hear what he says when it comes out in different colors, Bob.
He only missed,
they're great.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.